How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF. On today's episode, Ryan speaks with Guy Dauncey, an environmental visionary, about sustainability, human evolution, and what our future will look like.
It's nothing inherently evil or bad in humans. It's just that our historical way of behaving, which is like our nose immediately in front of our mouths and grab what we can and take when it's there, doesn't last for us now that we're a complete global civilization. We've got to think globally and use our brains globally.
Ryan also speaks with Estela Bastidas about the British Columbia Sustainable Energy Association's climate change showdown.
After the workshop, the grades 5 and 6 students, they take the challenge home and then they work with their parents for 4 weeks to reduce their energy consumption and then win prizes for becoming energy superheroes.
I'm Kim Tay.
And I'm Ryan Fletcher.
And you are listening to Sustainable Futures.
So, welcome to this week's Sustainable Futures. This week we're going to be talking with Guy Dauncey and Estela Bastidas, both from the BC Sustainable Energy Association. And Guy is the president.
Yeah, it's cool. I actually don't know much about the BC Sustainable Energy Association, so this will be a great opportunity for me to learn about some of the things that they do, because they have their hands in a number of different areas. You know, there are so many different energy alternatives that they promote on their website, which is www.bcsea.org.
Right. I'm on their mailing list, and it's a great resource for me. What you get is a lot of updates on sustainable energy throughout the world and also in North America and then in BC. So you get a picture of how BC compares to the rest of the country and then the rest of the continent and then the rest of the world. So, yeah, I find it to be very good. Yeah. And Guy Dauncey was a very interesting interview. He had a lot to say, and he's very, very impacting kind of speaker.
I haven't ever heard him speak before, but I have read his column, which is a monthly column in Common Ground, which mm-hmm. is a free monthly magazine type publication that you can get.
Yeah, I believe his column is called Earth Future.
Right. I really appreciate his perspective. He gives a very honest, realistic outlook on what the challenges are that we face, mm-hmm. but he also offers solutions to those problems as well.
Yes. This is actually the first interview I did in preparing to make this show, because I was really impressed with what he does. And for me, it's his positive language, his proactive and solution-oriented type way of speaking about climate change. He's very interested in solutions. He focuses on what's right, what can be done, rather than bemoaning all the things that are going wrong.
Which is, I think, a perspective that we need.
Yes.
We need a realistic perspective. No sense sugarcoating it.
Yes, and he doesn't.
No. Alrighty, well, here is Ryan's interview with Guy Dauncey.
Guy Dauncey is the president of the BC Sustainable Energy Association and author of many books, including Stormy Weather, 101 Solutions to Global Climate Change, Earth Future, Stories from a Sustainable World, The Unemployment Handbook, Nice Work If You Can Get It, After the Crash, The Emergence of the Rainbow Economy, and many, many more. He's also a regular columnist for Common Ground magazine and a terrific speaker and writer who does many engagements. So without further introduction, here is Guy Dantsey.
Why is sustainable future important to you?
What other kind of future can we possibly want? Because the future we're heading for at the moment is one in which we're using up all of the world's fish supplies out of the oceans. There's going to be none left. That within a matter of, 10 or 15 years, we are using up about three planets' worth of resources, which if everyone on Earth lived our lifestyle, we'd need three more planets to sustain that. We're heating up the atmosphere by use of fossil fuels. The list is long. We are stealing from the future generations. It's not sustainable what we're doing.
That's an interesting perspective, to be stealing from future generations, because it gives it a direct application.
Yeah. And it's happened in the past. Generations have done this in the past.
Yeah.
You just grab what's there in front of you and you don't think.
Yeah.
So you're going off your gut instincts and not your deeper brain. You're not thinking about what you're doing, and suddenly it's all gone. And quite often species died out in the past because of that. I don't think humans have a single chance of dying out. We're extremely innovative and robust. But I'm afraid the other species are going down very rapidly because of our actions.
Why do you think this is happening?
Ever since humans evolved on this planet in our modern form, and we started thinking and having written language and living in cities, we always treated nature as something that was there for us to get what we could out of. And to be truthful, every species does that. They just consume the resources around them. So we've grown up with a genetic inheritance of consume what's around you. And in the past, when you exhausted your landscape, you moved on, and then the landscape recovered behind you. All species do that. When the food runs out, they move somewhere else. And if need be, they have to conflict with another band of chimpanzees or muskrats or whatever it is, and they have to compete for food. As humans, we're doing that over the whole planet, and there's nowhere else to go to because we filled every single corner there is. We're now cutting down the last corners of the Amazon and the last in the Congo rainforest and Indonesia to meet our last resources. So we've got to sort of really pull up short and say, okay, stop and let's think here. It's nothing inherently evil or bad in humans. It's just that our historical way of behaving, which is like our nose immediately in front of our mouths and grab what we can and take when it's there, doesn't last for us now that we're a complete global civilization. We've got to think globally and use our brains globally. So it's calling us to do an evolutionary leap,
right,
to a higher level of functioning. Einstein once said that you can't solve the problem at the level at which the problem was created. You've got to move to a higher level in order to get a solution. And as a planet, we absolutely must move to a higher level. We cannot buy ourselves out of over-consumerism. We cannot use fossil fuels to burn ourselves out of, climate change. We've got to move to a higher level of functioning.
Like, what kind of leap are you talking about, a leap of consciousness?
It's a leap of consciousness from thinking that our nation is the most important thing to being aware that the world is the most important thing. Now, we've taken that leap many times in the past, when we moved from believing our clan was the most important or our family to belief in the tribe, and then from the belief in the tribe to the belief in the nation, then from the nation to belief in the supernation, and then from the supernation to the world. Now, this is, a long time evolutionary process, which is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And our inner being, our sense of identity and who we are, needs to have something to hold on to. And in the past, it's been, the clan. And everyone outside the clan was the enemy. And you're entitled to kill them, to rape their daughters, to steal from them, to attack them, because they're going to do the same to you, and that's the way the game is made. And we did that. The European tribes created World War II only 60 years ago. We were still in massive tribal warfare on a global level, killing each other to see who can be the biggest bully in the sandpit. And in the last 60 years, we've made an incredible transition to most people being aware that, no, we live in one world. We need to cooperate together as nations and not try and fight to see which is the biggest and strongest. There's one nation left that really wants to be the biggest and the strongest, that's the USA, many of whose people really believe that they are entitled to be the world's leaders and they are the best culture in the world. And they've got to get out of that delusion to realize that they're one among many and we need to cooperate together.
Okay. Yeah.
It's also a leap of technology. It's a leap of our technology away from the fossil fuel technologies that we've been using, burning coal, burning oil, burning gas, because it's there and available and let's grab it, to realizing that that's a one-off gift from the ancient past. Those fossil fuels were laid down 200 million years ago. We're burning the whole lot of them in 200 years,
uh-huh.
Which is an astonishing thought. But they give us the ability, to develop the mental and scientific and technological capacity to make solar voltaic cells, to make efficient electric cars and efficient light bulbs and wind turbines and tidal turbines. We couldn't have done any of that in 1750 before the industrial age started. So the fossil fuels gave us the industrial age and allowed us to transcend fossil fuels by moving entirely to energy coming from nature itself.
First, a comment about people sort of like the animal sense, just taking what's there and moving on. It makes me think of a time I talked, you said the start of our problems started with farming. What are your thoughts on that?
No, I don't think that's true at all. Farming was just one step of 100,000 steps. We started domesticating animals 100,000 years ago before farming. We've always simply used our intelligence to increase our prospects for survival and our comfort and our ability to prosper. Mm-hmm. Every species does that, both by their cleverness and the way they trap food, their ability to mate and have children, have secure families, and humans are no different. Farming was not a major disaster or negative step whatsoever. It was simply just another step forward.
Okay.
The challenge is always to be one step ahead of our actions, that our global thinking can be a step ahead of our actions, so we see where we're going in advance and plan or steer a clear pathway. It makes no sense to think we should always be living as hunter-gatherers. When you farm organically, you not only get more yields, so we can easily feed the world, but ecosystems are restored, you get more biodiversity, you get healthier food that's good for everyone, you can coexist with nature in a permacultural manner, with good permaculture-based organic farming, mm-hmm. without doing any damage to the planet. But we do need to cut back on eating meat. That is something that is a very heavy impact on the planet, because the amount of resources we need to feed into the cows and the pigs and the sheep is enormous and is causing desertification of the pasture lands. It's causing us to cut down the Amazon rainforest. It's pumping out up to a fifth of the global greenhouse gases of our global warming problem caused by the climate change gases produced by livestock. So we've got to cut back on eating meat. In the ideal diet, which I know that no one is going to adopt, we should be raw food vegans, eating that we evolved genetically in the ancient rainforest along with chimpanzees and primates to eat raw leaves and fruits and vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
That's the healthiest diet we can possibly have.
Yeah.
And none of us really want to do that, but the closer we get to a vegan diet of locally grown organic food, the better it is for the environment and the better it is for our own health and happiness as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm vegetarian and I'm moving towards vegan, but I'm a long way to go.
What motivates you to be so active in sustainability?
My motivation goes back to when I was at school, when the biggest thing that puzzled me at school, and I should say as soon as I left school, and because I was at a boarding school in England, so you're very isolated. Mm-hmm. As soon as I left school and opened my eyes to the main world, to the world, I became aware of warfare and poverty and homelessness and hunger and all these things. I thought, why do humans make such a mess of their lives? Why is it so chaotic when nature seems to be pretty orderly? And I studied sociology at university as a way to ask that question in a persistent manner, and I found the answers basically through a re-understanding of the nature of evolution, that evolution is not just the way it's interpreted by biological science, mm-hmm. which I love. I love evolutionary theory. But biological science only covers the evolution of the material form of the body and the cellular matter. It doesn't include the nature of the way consciousness evolves mm-hmm. in our relationship to the larger world of spirit. Mm-hmm. And that's something that science is not able to do yet because it hasn't found a way to measure and test and touch consciousness. It'll get there. It's moving in that direction through the healing arts in particular and the nature of cellular biology and healing.
Mm-hmm.
But it struck me, it realized that through the influence of a Catholic scientist and who is also a Jesuit priest called Teilhard de Chardin, mm-hmm. and then another Indian philosopher and yogi called Sri Aurobindo. I studied both of them intensively. And they are both saying that evolution is a co-evolution of material form and of the inner being. The greater and more complex the interior form, the more consciousness it can hold until consciousness can reflect on itself, can then meditate, can actually seek to have unity with the larger consciousness through the form of yoga and prayer and spirituality. And so now I'm looking at evolution not as being a random process by which the only thing happening is that genes are trying to replicate, but we're looking at an enhanced version of that, which says all that is true, but it's also true that life has a inner quest for wholeness. And this is something that takes me outside the normal proven scientific realm, but it's a process I call centropy, which balances the principle of entropy. It's the quest for wholeness. We always seek happiness and wholeness and fulfillment. Every nation seeks the same, and every species seeks the same. So why do we do that? If the only thing happening is we just want to breed, we just do that all life long, but we don't. We think, no, there's way more important things to do than just breeding. If we fill our lives with larger goals, with music, with poetry, with science, with technology, with explorations, with journeying, with visions of getting to the moon, of crossing the Atlantic, of being the first person to kayak around the world, with the first person to be a carbon-neutral lifestyle, with all these things drive us. We have an inner vision that drives us, coming from a place of greater wholeness that lies within our potential. So that's part of the evolutionary journey. And so when I understood this properly, I thought, this is such a cool way of understanding the planet. I'm going to spend my whole life talking about it, writing about it, singing about it, getting people inspired by it. And I got sidetracked into dealing with major issues like global climate change, environmental issues, cancer, unemployment issues, community-based economic development, which I've written, you know, my various books about. But I will be returning full-time to the work on evolutionary theory because I think it's the most important change that's needed.
You're listening to an interview with Guy Dauncey on sustainable futures.
I love the topic, too. I've read a lot of Robert Ardrey.
Well, it reminds us that we need to be constantly open-minded. Science has not solved all the problems of the world. Science has not closed the book on understanding. You've only got to gaze at the stars at night.
Yeah.
And think that this universe is 15 billion years old. No one has a clue what happened before the Big Bang, the origin of the universe, or before time existed, or how our consciousness fits into this major universe. I mean, science is only 400 years old in its modern form. There'll come a stage when it's 4,000 years old, and then when it's 40,000 years old, and think how much more we'll know and understand. Our belief in our self-importance or hubris gets in the way of our wisdom, which should start off with our appreciation of our ignorance and how little we know. And then understanding that, okay, we know so little, let's take step by step by step towards greater wisdom and understanding and not feel self-important and clever. Because our major problem environmentally comes from the hubris and self-importance we got from fossil fuels and science and technology. We think, we've done all this amazing stuff. We can go to the moon. We can fly in these amazing airplanes. We can break these speed records. Aren't we great, we think? Until someone turns around and said, yeah, you've now put so much power into your fishing fleet that they're fishing every darn last fish out of the oceans. 90% of all the world's fish stocks are going to be gone by the year 2015. All of our politicians in democracies need to be guided by a council of elders and a council of children to remind ourselves to plan for 7 generations ahead or 100 generations ahead. My wife's on holiday in Mexico at the moment to give her a break for the winter, and she says that the people she's meeting down there are retired Americans who are simply killing time by drinking and smoking. They haven't a clue what they're doing with their lives. They've got no thought in their brains. They got the money to do it. It's cheaper down there, $25 a night in a hotel. They're just drinking and smoking. Terribly tragic comment on life. So we've got to look to young people to keep our spirits alive and full of new ideas and challenge us with new ideas and new approaches. There are plenty of older people who have great wisdom as well, like David Suzuki, you know, like Margaret Mead before she died, many older people full of wisdom, like Thomas Berry. On the whole, we're heading in the wrong direction rapidly. But this last year, 2007, was a real global awakening. People suddenly realized that the stuff the environmental community has been talking about wasn't just a special interest group or an idea they had. This is for real. We really are messing up. Listen to what they're saying and pay attention, because everything they've been saying for the past 30 years is basically right. Things the hippies were saying in the 1960s are basically correct. You know, we need to plan on living simply. More happiness and love and fulfillment instead of trying to get more stuff. More stuff leads to more misery. Bigger divorce arguments, bigger debts, bigger worries, more theft. It doesn't bring more happiness. Once you got beyond a basic 20,000, 30,000 year income, there's no increase in happiness.
I wanted to ask you about Common Ground because that's where I became familiar with your work. Is that something you write for monthly, or is it actually...
Yeah, I have a Common Ground magazine coming out of Vancouver. It's been going for, I think, 25 years, or is it 20 years now? And I have a regular monthly column. So every month, I've done this for about 5 years now. I treat it as a little adventure in my own thinking, like, what am I going to write about this month? And I always want to keep it exciting to myself, because then it's exciting to the reader. Sometimes I focus on environmental issues, sometimes I focus on spiritual issues, sometimes I just focus on the big questions, like, you know, what are we doing in this universe? To raise questioning and passion and excitement in the reader. That's my little goal. Okay. And Common Ground's been, you know, a great magazine, been going on for a long time. Joseph Roberts does a wonderful job there.
As president of the BC SEA, the
BC
Energy Association.
That's right, yes.
So you've been informed about a lot of developments in sustainability. What is some of the most exciting developments you see going on in BC right now?
Well, frankly, it's the fact that the government has gotten right behind the climate change initiative.
Okay, yeah.
And all of the resistance that used to exist has vanished. Resistance that was a mixture of indifference and other things are more important and we can't afford it and it's not really true and it doesn't really matter, all that's gone. The leadership we're seeing from the cabinet is saying, this is for real, it's serious, it's urgent, and we've got to do everything we can. Even if there are contradictions, like the fact that we're still subsidizing fossil fuels, there's still plans for the Gateway Program to build roads and bridges in the Lower Mainland, which will increase the amount of traffic and greenhouse gas emissions. That's kind of to be expected when you get a government changing course so rapidly, and it's certainly our hope that those climate contradictions will one by one be removed over the next 2 or 3 years. So that's a very good process, and the environmental community is involved with the government in trying to make it work, along with the business community and other people in government. The wind energy movement is about to get on the ground in British Columbia. We're going to see our first wind turbines probably early next year, which is exciting, and then hopefully a lot more to follow. I would love to say we're going to see a lot more electric vehicles, but they're very slow to get going. Electric bicycles are taking off. A lot of people are discovering electric bicycles and electric scooters as a great way to get around. Mm-hmm. Solar energy is going to be very slow to take off because we haven't yet got the government support, but solar hot water is going to be taking off quite soon. We got some traction around solar hot water with more interest in that.
How does that work now? I haven't heard much about that one.
Basically, the new technology is solar evacuated tubes on your roof. Basically, it traps the sun's heat and use it to heat water. China has like 30 million solar hot water systems on the roofs of their buildings over there. We're almost none in Canada. And so often we don't know how far behind the bus we are because the bus, you know, left a long time ago. And things that if you go to Britain, Holland, Austria, Germany, you see roofs of solar panels on them. You see wind turbines. You see bicycles on the streets. You see little small smart cars. Mm-hmm. There's so much more happening on the streets. We're still a little bit stuck in the fact that energy is so cheap, oil is so cheap. Land is so multi-present, there's so many trees out there, the ocean's so full of fish, we're still indulging in North America. And we really haven't understood that we've got to learn to live within a small planet. The other thing that's exciting is the real growth of interest in locally grown organic food. Here in Vancouver Island, we import 95% of our food. And it's certainly true, you know, for the Lower Mainland, most of the food is still imported, so we're not growing anywhere near enough local organic food. But it's a lot of interest, a lot of people want to do that. The problem is the price of land. How do we get young people onto the land where they can grow food?
Yeah.
And that needs a really serious attention.
Yeah, certainly a lot of people want to do it.
Yeah, but when land is studying for the price of real estate, you can't ever possibly begin to start. There's got to be a strengthening of the agricultural land reserve and a means to allow young people to get into the market.
With all of the millions, it seems, of sustainable energy solutions, which do you believe is really the one that's going to take off more than the others?
We need to accelerate all of them simultaneously.
Yeah.
Solar energy globally is already taking off at an expansion rate of 40% per annum, which is unheard of. The wind energy is expanding at around 25% per annum. So they're both on a roll globally. They're so much on a roll that it's hard to get hold of wind turbines. The manufacturing of the actual equipment is lagging behind because it's so much global demand. The next really big one that's about to expand is what's called solar thermal energy in the world's deserts. Whether it's North Africa or Nevada or New Mexico, there's phenomenal solar thermal potential, which you can use to trap heat to then basically boil water and run turbines and distribute electricity around North America. Mm-hmm. So that's about to take off. And then the one that's hiding underground, quite literally, is Deep Rock's geothermal energy. It's a real sleeper at the moment that when we tap into the energy deep down, I mean, talking 6 to 10 kilometers down, which is beyond the range of current drilling. Yeah. When you drill into granite that deep, you've got enough energy in the USA for 20,000 times more power than the country needs. Mm. And in Canada, that means 200,000 times more power than we need. The same analysis shows up for Australia and Europe. So this is a new technology we need to break into. Then it's basically the future is electricity. The future is not biofuel and it's not hydrogen, it's electricity, which means that electricity storage systems become really important, whether it's batteries or underground storage or other systems. Mm-hmm. But it's a very exciting time, and the investors know that it's a really exciting time. In 1996, there was around $7 billion invested in renewable energy. The predictions for 2006 were going to be around $70 billion. In reality, in 2007, it was $117 billion invested in renewable energy, solar and wind and microhydro and solar hot water and geothermal and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Huge. This is bigger than the previous dot-com revolution. The dot-com revolution led to every digital device we have today, from cell phones to laptops to iPods to JPEGs to, you know, MP3s and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. The renewable energy revolution is going to do just the same. Just we got to really understand the power of this, how deep this is.
So looking at today and where we are sort of in this process of change,
yes.
Do you think there's going to be some kind of tipping point, or is it just going to be continue on this gradual pace?
Well, there was a tipping point in the mentality around global climate change last year. Mm-hmm. It happened. The sense that people who are skeptics and deniers and complainers and whiners and moaners who believe they had better science than the scientists vanished. You know, they're really... the few mad dogs barking on the rooftop now, when the rest of the world is saying, this is really so serious, like, get on with it. Stop paying attention to those people. Mm-hmm. And it showed up at the World's Climate Change Conference in Bali in December, when only America was standing out as resistance against the progress that was needed. The delegates were getting so impatient, and the delegate from Papua New Guinea finally stood up and said, look, America, either lead or get out of the way. And the American delegate then withdrew her objections, mm-hmm. and the whole world moved ahead. That was a real breakthrough moment when the whole pressure of global public opinion said to the Americans, for God's sake, pull your finger out. Stop being such an a blank, 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 mm-hmm. which is the way they were behaving as a nation. Of course we need to involve India and China and all the other countries. And that'll happen. Because I do believe that American democracy has gone off the rails. It's been corrupted by corporate influence in the White House and throughout the electoral system. You have to raise so many million dollars to run, to be a Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton. You've got to raise so much money that it's corrupted. The system we have now in Canada would be unbelievable to most Americans. No corporation or labor union gives any money whatsoever to a candidate for political office. And no individual could give more than $1,000. And we're funded by proportional funding based on how many votes you got in the last election. That is far more democratic. Canada is a much more democratic country than USA when it comes to campaign finance. In other systems, America is more democratic than Canada because they allow more direct intervention by citizens. But America is the global problem in many ways, and it's their self-importance that is the problem, the belief that no one should tell them what to do, because that stops them cooperating with the global initiatives tied to the United Nations and other things. And I really hope that there's going to be a mind change, a huge sea change in the federal election, the presidential election this November. I really hope that we get a democratic, not only a president, but also a good majority in Congress and Senate. Because the last time that happened, which was LBJ in 1967, I think, it led to a huge sea change and a lot of changes. A lot of Americans are in such distress about the direction their government is leading them in.
One of the really big developments is, of course, the North American Union. Where do you see that playing into the whole structure?
Well, I see it as really not something you want to do.
Yeah.
Now, the paradox is that the European Union has been extremely successful and a very good initiative because it stopped the European nations fighting with each other. Mm-hmm. But there are many European nations, and the biggest understanding is that the two real big countries, Germany and France, will never be allowed to dominate the whole Union. So if you've got a European Union of now, heaven knows, 28, 30 countries, you've got a balance. A North American Union of three countries, where one is a 100-ton gorilla, one is a tiny country called Canada, and one is a very impoverished country called Mexico, is not a fair union. It's a takeover by American-dominated corporate power. Mm-hmm. And so really, it's not the way to go. We need cooperation, but we don't need currency union, we don't need free borders, we don't need free trade agreements that allow Americans to take all our water and take everything else. It's too imbalanced. I am concerned that there's a current running among certain people in privacy to bring the two countries, to blend them together. And it would be great to have the lack of border restrictions that exist in Europe, but Europe doesn't have Mexico as part of, you know, so every Mexican would cross the border tomorrow morning, probably, you know, if they were allowed to. So we've got a different set of issues in North America.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for sharing your time with us, Guy.
It's been my pleasure. My website is earthfuture.com. The BC Sustainable Energy Association is bcsea.org, so you can find all my projects through those websites.
All right. Well, there you have it.
The direct Guy Donzie.
Definitely. Well, that was a very intense interview, and we'll totally discuss that later. But on to something that is a little bit more lighthearted. We're talking to, or rather, you're talking to Estella Bastidas, who runs the BC Sustainable Energy Association's Climate Change Showdown. Ryan, tell us a little bit about what that's about.
Well, it's a school program that is being run for quite a few years now. And with the new school season coming up, you'll be able to look into it yourselves if you're having some children in school this year. And Estella tells us all about the program and how to become an energy superhero.
I like superheroes, especially the ones that have to do with the environment.
Me too. I'm always looking around for superheroes.
Cool. Here is Estella Bastidas.
So this is Ryan Fletcher from Sustainable Futures interviewing Estella Bastidas, the project manager of the Climate Change Showdown from the BC Sustainable Energy Association. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you, Ryan. Thanks for the invitation.
So starting off, what is the Climate Change Showdown?
Well, the Climate Change Showdown is an educational and community outreach program that has been created by the nonprofit BC Sustainable Energy Association. And to be more specific, the Climate Change Showdown is a fun and informative workshop for grade 5 and 6 students that teaches them about climate change, how they can reduce their carbon footprint, and also gives them an incentive to carry actions that will change their lifestyle at homes and in their community as well.
So it's education grades 5 and 6. Is this in the public schools?
Yes, this is an education program to elementary schools. And the program has successfully delivered free workshops. We are delivering free workshops in elementary school classrooms. And this program started in 2005. With just a few workshops in Kamloops, and then developed to 150 workshops in the GVRD area in 2006. And during this past school year, 2007-2008, the program reached over 550 classes, and we estimate about 14,000 families that have been reached across BC. So then you can see that we have developed from a few in Kamloops to 550 across BC.
So it's growing. It seems to be growing very fast. Is it going all across BC then?
Yeah, so we have been already in BC, and we have been in places such as Haida-Wai, Southern Vancouver Island. We have also been in Comox, Lower Mainland, Howe Sound, including Whistler, Pemberton, Garibaldi, also in the West Kootenays, Nelson Trail, Grand Forks, also in Kelowna, Kamloops, and South Peace in Dawson Creek. So as you can see, we have been all over the province.
So when you do this project, does that involve do people actually go to the schools, or is it something that the teachers receive?
We have hired people at local level through our BC Sustainable Energy Association's local chapters in all these areas that I have mentioned to you. And then we have these workshops are in-class delivered workshops. So we have educators who are well-trained on climate change and also on classroom management, and these very qualified people, they go to the classroom and offer this program for 80 minutes, and then and during the program, so our presenters are giving kids very fun and illustrative learning on climate change by using both video question and answers, and also we use a climate change game that has been created by the BC Sustainable Energy Association as well. So as you can see, it's a very interactive workshop, and the showdown itself has found a very successful way to influence household behavior and reduce carbon emissions. And you may think, by why you are affecting households. Well, the reason why is that after the workshop, the grade 5 and 6 students, they take the challenge home. This is a challenge with 13 different actions that they can do at home. Mm-hmm. And then they work with their parents for 4 weeks to reduce their energy consumption and then win prizes for becoming energy superheroes.
Superheroes.
Yes.
Well, that's great.
Yeah. So, and also we have estimated that the impact of the activities that these kids are doing along with their families is a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by approximately 10,000 tons per year.
That sounds pretty good.
Yes.
So this started 2005, is that right?
Yes, you're right.
How did it start? Where did it come from?
Well, this is a very good question. So it started in the BC Sustainable Energy Association local chapter in Kamloops, where young people there decided that they wanted to really have something, a learning experience for kids about climate change without being so hard on them. So then they decided, why not to go with a board game, and that's how the climate change game was born. And then that climate change game has been incorporated into a, you know, wider workshop. Last year, during a pilot project in the GVRD area, in which the climate change game was delivered to 150 classes. And that's how the workshop initially started, with just the game, and then now we are, the workshop has been extended to an 80-minute workshop that also includes not only the game, but also a video component, and also the contest, which is called the Climate Change Showdown Contest for prizes, in which we encourage kids not only to empower themselves during the workshop, but also to bring forward what they have learned during their classroom experience at their homes. So that's what we wanted to do with the contest. So that's how the workshop has developed into a community outreach program. And that's how we are reaching out as well families through their kids.
So how does the contest work? What are they trying to achieve?
Well, the contest works that we gave the kids 4 weeks after the workshop to complete 13 different actions,
right,
that ranges from switching their shower heads for low flow shower heads, for example, or turning off unused lights, or go car free 1 day a week for 4 weeks. For example, those are the activities, but there are like 13 different activities that ranges from transportation activities to food-wise activities, like go meat-free for 1 day a week for 4 weeks, for example. Mm-hmm. So then, but the kids have to ask their parents to sign their contest forms. So therefore, the parents are also involved in the contest.
Mm-hmm.
And also because we are asking also kids to measure their tire, for example, air pressure. And by doing that, so they need their parents' help, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's how we are being able to also engage their parents into this process of reducing energy consumption. And then after the 4 weeks, the kids bring back their contest forms to the teachers, and the teachers send those things back to us. We provided all the materials, prepaid postage and everything to teachers. And then we do the scoring at the, you know, at the central offices located all across BC, wherever the, mm-hmm. the workshop has been delivered. And then after the scoring, so then we have the winners. And in fact, the month of June was the month of celebration.
Right.
We have all these different over 200 superheroes across BC, celebrating and getting different prizes for their actions that they have achieved.
Oh, that's great. And how does the scoring work? Is that is it based on how little they used the car, like how effective they were in the 13 actions?
Well, you are, yes. So these are things that we have been developed along with the one of our core sponsors here in the Lower Mainland, the City of Vancouver. We have been developed a scoring criteria, and basically our rationale for scoring the contest is to create a behavioral change. So those kids who have not done any activity like changing, you know, light bulbs in the past, and as a result of the program, as a result of the workshop, if they end up changing the light bulbs or if they end up reducing energy, those kids are getting more points. Why? Because we are trying to get those families and those kids who have never done any mm-hmm. actions before. And that's how we are encouraging behavioral change. And you may think that is, you know, what happened with the other kids who have already mm-hmm. done, you know, very good with the environment. Well, we believe that those kids are already being trained, and they are already superheroes. So those kids are, actually, those are not our target audience. Our target audience is the mainstream families.
Right.
And then, therefore, by providing prizes and providing this competition, kids are, especially at this age, grade 5 and 6, they respond better to competition, and they respond yeah. better to really go back and engage their parents into this kind of action.
Yeah, I think that's you're right there. It's a good age. Yeah.
Yes, and also because these kids become an agent of change for a program, and basically that's what we are targeting. We are targeting behavioral change.
Okay, and with the contest. Again, going back to the contest, is there provincial winners, or how does the winners?
Well, the winners depends on the area where the local regional coordinators are. For example, we had winners in the Lower Mainland, but also because in the Lower Mainland we have city sponsors that provided funding for the project. So, for example, we had winners in the city of Richmond, Coquitlam, and city of Vancouver in the Lower Mainland, but also we provided some prizes for the top student outside those cities in New Westminster, and also the top class in Barnaby for the Lower Mainland. And also we had winners in the southern Vancouver Island in Victoria, area, and also winners in Dawson Creek, in Kamloops, in Kelowna, in Nelson, and in Grand Forks.
Okay.
And also in Howe Sound, including Whistler and Pemberton.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for spending time with us, Estella.
So that was Estella Bastidas of the Climate Change Showdown.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun for kids to do. And I'm glad that they, you know, that it's right across the province and that it's teaching a younger generation about climate change. And it's actually making them bring it home and teaching mm-hmm. their parents and, you know, helping them actually put those things into action rather than it just being just a verbal promise that you're going to do things like that. So I think that that's key.
Yeah, especially in the school systems, because I remember going through school and everything was just theory. A lot of the time, I know I never actually got to do stuff, like applied hands-on things. So it's great to see something in the school system that is like that, because I think children are just latch on to that stuff. They like to be doing things.
I can remember when I was in elementary school, the only thing that I was really taught about the environment was to not let the water run when I was brushing my teeth, and that if you also put a little container of rocks into your toilet well, that it would decrease the amount of water that you used when you flushed the toilet. So I can remember doing that. I went into our backyard and I got rocks and I put them in our toilet well. I think they're still there, actually. You haven't? Oh, no. Totally.
Hmm.
The rocks were in our toilet, so whether that's right or wrong, they were in there.
All I remember being told is don't litter.
That too. That too. You know, we've said in the past, we've said on past shows how important it is for a younger generation to learn what it is like to conserve energy. And so this is just the perfect example of this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. In applied action, both Estella and Guy connect in that it seems to me that the climate change showdown is carrying on a lot of the things that Guy Dancy brings to the Sustainable Energy Association. And I was just thinking about the language, even the climate change showdown. The word showdown has a sense of immediacy, like you need a superhero or something to help.
Like a duel or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I really appreciated Guy Dancy's interview. It was very intense, and you can hear the passion and urgency in his voice. I think it's a message and a point of view and a perspective that we really need to hear, because I think a lot of times we do tend to sugarcoat things, even though we know the immediacy of it. I, for example, can understand the immediacy of it, but sometimes I tend to take a more softer approach and I tend to say, well, you know, small steps, everything starts somewhere. And that is true. That is very, very true. But I appreciate when somebody is able to really say point blank, this is what we're facing. And if we don't do X, Y, and Z, this is going to be the outcome. You know, what do you want? I don't think that his perspective is communicated enough, especially in the media, because people don't want to hear that the party is over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want to hear that the party is over. You know, I mean, it's not something that humans in general want to hear, but even though we need it. So that's why I think that, you know, hearing somebody like Guy Dancy is important.
Yeah, he comes up to you and he says, we must change. You don't hear that on the regular media.
I can see that changing in the future. I think it has to change. What's really interesting, by the time this show airs on Friday, the current edition of the Georgia Strait will no longer be on stands. This is, I'm talking about this week's that was published last Thursday. There is an article about Boyd Cohen in that newspaper. Boyd Cohen is a professor here at Simon Fraser University, and he's also the founder of thirdwhale.com, which you've probably heard a lot about his contest that he's having right now for the greenest person in the world. And that's been picked up by mainstream media and alternative media all over the world. But his article is really interesting. If the listeners can get a hold of a copy of last week's edition of the Georgia Strait, it's really, really interesting because he speaks about mainstream media and how in a lot of cases, we tend to promote small things, you know, mm-hmm. like don't litter, don't leave the tap on when you're brushing your teeth and that type of thing. He says that he's worried that his 4-year-old son's quality of life is going to be dramatically reduced because we're not doing something dramatic enough.
Yeah, I think in most cases, the media is not a very good resource. One thing about one of our past interviews that really struck me was when we had Stewart's interview with Carl Loskin, and he mentioned the fact that it is factory farming is causing more pollution than the automobile industry. And who hears about the farming on a daily basis? You know, we hear about the automobile industry, and by solely focusing on that, we're missing the actual biggest contributor.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Two very interesting interviews again today, Ryan. One, a very sobering one. One, a very lighthearted, fun one to do with superheroes. So We would like to encourage everybody to be their own climate superhero. Dun da da da. And now for your environmental news update. Greenpeace is reporting this week that the Great Barrier Reef has been saved from a potentially harmful shale mine production. A 20-year moratorium was placed on all new shale oil projects in the region. The site of the proposed project would have been built only 10 kilometers from the Great Barrier Reef, which would have exposed the reef and region to excessive water use, toxic leaching, and air pollution. Shale oil production is extremely greenhouse gas intensive. Emissions from this project, combined with the company's other planned operations, would have raised Australia's current total emissions by 30% within 20 years. The fight and victory against the shale mine was led by a local group called Save Our Foreshore Group. According to Greenpeace, the success shows how powerful local grassroots campaigns can be. And Walmart announced this week that it plans to go greener next year by building more energy-efficient stores. The new high-efficiency stores, or HE stores, will reportedly help the company decrease energy consumption by 30%. To achieve this goal, the new stores will feature motion sensor display lights, LED lights and storefront signs, and low-flow water fixtures, among other features. The new stores will also be smaller in size. Walmart Canada President and CEO David Cheesewright is confident that Walmart stores will be among the greenest on the block. This announcement was made by Cheesewright at the annual conference of the Association of Municipalities of Ontario. U.S. scientists from the National Snow and Ice Data Center are reporting that Arctic sea ice has decreased to the second smallest extent on record. Last year's summer melt produced the smallest area of Arctic ice on record, but scientists are predicting that the Arctic is on the verge of breaking last year's record because this year's summer melt started earlier than usual. Satellite imaging of Arctic ice started 30 years ago. Since then, ice has started to decline more sharply. And this decline might be happening faster than we actually think. A few years ago, climate models were predicting ice-free summers by 2080. Then they started to predict earlier dates, and today, some scientists believe that the Arctic could have ice-free summers within 5 years. The Arctic's precarious situation certainly does not sound promising for one of its most well-known inhabitants, the polar bear. On the heels of the announcement from the American National Snow and Ice Data Center, the Canadian government was proposing a national roundtable on polar bear conservation. Canada's Environment Minister, John Baird, said that he will start setting up a national roundtable that will bring key stakeholders together to discuss the conservation and protection of Canada's polar bear population. The proposed roundtable will look at scientific information, as well as traditional northern knowledge, and would include environmental groups, Inuit and First Nations people, government representatives, and other experts. And lastly, Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama accepted the Democratic Party presidential nomination last night. During his speech, Obama promised to end the United States' dependence on oil from the Middle East. Obama committed to invest in clean coal technology, find ways to safely harness nuclear power, build a domestic fuel-efficient car industry while making these types of cars affordable for Americans. If all of Obama's goals are carried through, we could see $150 billion invested over the next decade in renewable sources of energy, such as wind and solar energy. On Wednesday night, Democratic vice presidential candidate Joe Biden touted the Obama administration for making alternative energy a national priority, creating 5 million new jobs as a result, and finally breaking the U.S. from the grip of foreign oil. Both Biden and Obama accused Republican candidate John McCain for consistently voting against renewable energy such as wind, solar, and biofuel power. And that's been your environmental news update for Friday, August the 29th. That brings our show to a close. Thank you very, very much for tuning in today. We hope you will join us next week at 3 p.m., next Friday, that is. I'm Kim Tay.
And I'm Ryan Fletcher.
And we're wishing you
a sustainable future.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.